Welcome back to the Nutrition and Life podcast. My name is Lisa, I'm your host, and in today's episode, I'm speaking with board-certified oncology dietitian Crystal Soniga. Crystal and I speak about evidence-based strategies for cancer prevention throughout cancer treatment and for survivors. I hope you enjoy the episode, and please, if you like the show, subscribe and give us a rating or take a screenshot and share the episode on your social media. Thank you so much, and as always, if you want personalized help with your nutrition and fitness goals, we are your go-to coaches. Just hit the contact link in the show notes for more details. Now onto my conversation with Crystal. Crystal Soniga, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Very, very excited to dig into your area of expertise, oncology and nutrition in that field. To start off with, though, I would love to hear from you. What's the number one thing you're excited for our listeners to learn from our conversation today?
I'm excited for this audience to learn about the connection between nutrition, physical activity, and cancer risk.
Wonderful. I think this is a really, really important topic for everyone to learn more about. And I mean, speaking of you being a dietitian and oncology specialized dietitian, I would love to hear how you got into this field.
So my undergraduate degree, I was pursuing a bachelor's degree in dietetics on track to become a dietitian. And then I got engaged in some research as an undergrad, and they're actually doing research on a compound that was found in tomatoes and pomegranate and how that impacted the growth of cancer cells. And that really opened my mind into seeing the power of nutrition, that the nutrients and other compounds that we're consuming can impact cancer. Decided to take a little detour and go get my PhD in nutrition because I really wanted to learn more about that. And so my research and my PhD was on dietary interventions for prevention of prostate cancer. So then I had combined having my dietetics, doing a dietetic internship as a dietitian, and then having that background in that relationship between nutrition and cancer. So now I'm able to merge the two of being able to help people during and after cancer treatment through nutrition, and also keeping up with the research in relation to this really rapidly growing field.
Oh, what an important work that you're doing. And I love how you're empowering people on all fronts of cancer in terms of prevention throughout any journey they might be having, or and also cancer survivors. So we're definitely going to get into each of these specific phases. So let's start off with the first one. What should we know in terms of cancer prevention? What, especially in regards to nutrition, how can we optimize our nutrition in order to prevent our risk for cancer?
Sure. So it's estimated that only 5 to 10% of cancers are related to a genetic predisposition for that cancer. And so the rest is going to be related to our environment and lifestyle factors. And so it is estimated that about 40% of cancer cases could be prevented through lifestyle factors. And that includes things like alcohol, smoking, diet, physical activity, UV exposure, those types of things. So when we look at that understanding of nutrition and physical activity, I really like to refer to our guidelines. So we do have guidelines about this, and those are developed from research. And that's a collaboration between the American Institute for Cancer Research and the World Cancer Research Fund. They bring together a panel of experts to evaluate the evidence, and with that have developed our cancer prevention recommendations. And so I'll briefly go over what they are, just list them, and then we can dig into those a little bit further. But one of them is maintain a healthy weight. Another is eating a diet rich in fruits, vegetables, beans, legumes, and whole grains. Limiting processed foods, sugar sweetened beverages, limiting red meat and avoiding processed meats. They say it is best to avoid alcohol for cancer prevention purposes, and being physically active for those that breastfeed, if possible, for those individuals. And then it says actually do not use supplements for cancer prevention. So those are kind of the big picture cancer prevention guidelines. So it sounds a lot like what we recommend for reducing the risk of other chronic diseases. So eating a minimally processed diet, rich in plants, limit processed foods, and that can help lower the risk of cancer.
I love all these pointers. As you said, they sound mostly like things that we should be doing or looking out for a quote unquote healthy lifestyle anyway. I'm really curious about that last one in terms of the supplements. What sort of supplements would people or have people been thinking of in terms of cancer prevention?
Yes, there's a lot of marketing about supplements for overall health, but for cancer prevention, maybe some marketed that they can be antioxidants, so it could prevent DNA damage and that could lower the risk of cancer. But they put that specific recommendation out because there were some early clinical trials in the 90s where they were looking at giving an intervention. And I'll give one specific example here of beta carotene and vitamin A for previous smokers or those that were smokers or had exposure to asbestos, because they thought these are people who are at high risk of lung cancer. So what if we gave them an antioxidant? Could that lower their risk of lung cancer? Well, actually, that they have to stop the study early because it increased the risk of lung cancer and increased the risk of death. So that was just one of these examples that more is not better of these types of compounds, because once we start using them at levels beyond what we actually need, they might function differently in our body. So that type of study really raised awareness and caution around using supplements for specific purposes of cancer prevention.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, especially also since unfortunately supplements are not always super regulated and sometimes they might say a certain dosage and then be completely different. So I think that's probably a good plan in the sense of sticking with the minimal supplement regime. I mean, I as a nutrition coach, I do sometimes recommend certain supplements like omega-3 or creatine or something like that to people, but those tend to be the quote unquote safer ones with a lot of research to back them up in other areas, but obviously not necessarily for cancer research. But you touched on certain micronutrients, you touched on vitamin B and so on. And I think what you do such a wonderful job at and on your social media is also educating us more specifically how we can come across all the micronutrients our body needs to be maximally equipped to fight off cancer, I guess. And I'd love to go through a few of them if you don't mind. And so, of course, I hope the listeners go and check out your content in any case. But for example, something like soy. I saw on your social media, and I think soy has often or has had a bit of a bad run because for a while, especially women and breast cancer and so on, and the talks about its effect on estrogen have kind of like, oh, don't consume any soy at all. But technically, soy has a lot of health benefits. So, what should we know about soy as it pertains to cancer prevention and nutrition in general?
Yeah, so a lot of misinformation around soy, saying that it should be avoided because it could cause breast cancer, or those that have hormone sensitive breast cancer should avoid it because it's going to cause their cancer to grow or come back. But when we actually look at let's start with where that came from, that yes, soy has these compounds, isoflavones, which are in the family of phytoestrogens, meaning that these are compounds in these plants that have a similar structure to estrogen, but they are not estrogen. I like to bust that myth when people say soy has estrogen. It's not our human estrogen. It's a different structure, which means that it doesn't quite fit in our estrogen receptors. It doesn't quite elicit that same potency of signal. And when we look at the animal studies, when they're giving high doses of these extracted compounds, yes, there was some evidence that it increased tumor growth of breast cancer sensitive to hormone sensitive breast cancer tissue. That's isolated doses, high concentrations. What about when we actually consume a food? And the evidence has shown that actually soy consumption may lower the risk of breast cancer. We see that a lot more in Asian populations and American populations, either having null effect or a positive benefit. But then when we look at those that actually have had a hormone receptor positive breast cancer, meaning that estrogen sensitive, the research has shown that consumption of soy in this population has actually lowered the risk of breast cancer recurrence, lowered the risk of breast cancer-related mortality, and lowered the risk of all-cause related mortality, so that those compounds in those soy foods are actually offering protection in this population. And also, soy foods are a great way to help replace the animal products, and that soy foods also contain fiber and other compounds that are beneficial. So, long story short of this is that it's still a myth that's still going around. So, just because you're hearing it doesn't mean that it's true. The science has actually shown when we look at populations of humans consuming these foods for long periods of time, it seems to offer protection, even those with estrogen receptor positive cancers.
Amazing. Yeah, I think it's great that you're busting that myth from a very science-backed up way. And you mentioned animal products there. So oftentimes soy, especially soy milk, is used to replace dairy products. And so what's the deal with dairy? Should we stay away from that in terms of cancer prevention, or is that something we can consume with good conscience?
Yeah, so dairy consumption seems to be associated with a higher risk of prostate cancer, and that might be related to the calcium relationship there. When we look at other cancers, dairy consumption has actually been associated with a lower risk of colorectal cancer. Same with breast cancer. So actually, we're seeing more of a protective effect of dairy, except for that one instance of prostate cancer. It's also really important to delineate what dairy, like dairy is a big group of foods. Greek yogurt, low-fat Greek yogurt is very different than butter, cream, ice cream, those types of things. So really that benefit is coming from more of these low-fat types of dairy products.
Yeah, and I assume it might also be somewhat mechanistically through the calcium that you mentioned in there. Is calcium a micronutrient to look out for, to try to get more of as it pertains to cancer prevention?
Yeah, that might be one that most of us are lacking in if you're not consuming those dairy products. And yes, there actually a study that came out in relation to colorectal cancer recently, seeing that association with calcium intake through foods or even combination of foods and supplements associated with a lower risk. So calcium could be a micronutrient to focus on.
Okay, great. And another micronutrient, or I guess rather hormone perhaps, that many people fall short of, to my knowledge, is vitamin D. How is that involved in cancer prevention?
Yeah, so there's a lot of emerging research in vitamin D. When they updated the vitamin D recommendations, they were actually looking at cancer prevention as a potential marker about where to set the vitamin D recommended intake, but they didn't have quite enough evidence there yet. So our recommendations are still around bone health, but they were looking at this research that there does seem to be an association with low vitamin D status and higher risk of cancer. So there has been some research suggesting that we should try to optimize our vitamin D levels. I know right now the US Preventative Task Force doesn't recommend routine screening of vitamin D levels. So I know the research is still mixed in that area, but I'll say personally, for my cancer survivors, I recommend that they all get it checked. And again, might be just my bias in my private practice. I would say 9 times out of 10, my patients are low in vitamin D levels.
Unfortunately, it really is the case due to our current lifestyles and most of us being inside the majority of the time. And I guess building on that, because we're so big on like practical recommendations for people as well, what are some things when someone comes to you and says, "Hey, Crystal, I would love to change my lifestyle a little bit to help prevent any form of cancer." What do you recommend in terms of lifestyle practices and nutritional practice, like actionable things that I do?
Yeah, I always like, we definitely don't start at the supplement piece, right? So the practical approach is like, let's look at what you are currently eating. And as we know, the standard American diet is very high in processed foods, tends to be low in fiber. And I'd say that's one of the nutrients that I do put a lot of focus on is fiber and trying to set goals around increasing fiber, because where is fiber coming from? Whole foods, plant foods. And that really helps people focus on one nutrient instead of trying to balance protein and fat and what are carbs are bad. Like, let's try to fiber target, and then we do start to see some reduction in the processed foods, reductions in the animal products that have more room for fruits, vegetables, whole grains, beans, and legumes. Because yes, there's a lot of evidence about the benefits of fiber. And what's also helpful for fiber is that it helps people feel more satisfied. So then they're eating less, and that can help with maintaining a healthy body weight. So my practical strategies really do start with, let's focus on one nutrient. What are the foods that have that nutrient, and how can we get more of that in your diet? Because we know most Americans are not meeting our fruit, vegetable intake, whole grain recommendations, fiber intake. And so starting there is a good place to start.
What I love about this approach is that it's focused on what to add in as opposed to that sort of negative approach of like, I can't have this and you should never have that. And where people just automatically have a negative connotation with the whole approach, and rather just thinking what, like you said, like they're eating more of the vegetables, so automatically having less of the processed things and maybe less processed animal products as especially. So really great first step. And then so building on that, of course, we also know that the majority of the population doesn't move enough, or as I mentioned, we're not outside enough. And so yeah, again, practically speaking, how do you get your clients or anyone asking to embrace that more and make that part of their daily lives?
Yeah, I always like to start with that approach too, as you mentioned, like adding more when it comes to the diet, and then with the exercises, something is better than nothing. Let's start exploring what movement that you like to do, because the recommendation isn't 150 minutes of running. It isn't around that, right? It's around moderate to vigorous physical activity, meeting 150 minutes. So, what are the activities that you enjoy? And let's start there. And then also know it's a dose response. So, the more that you do, the up to a certain point, the more that you do, the more benefit that you're going to get. So, some think, well, if I can't do a 30-minute session at one time, then what's the point? It's like, could we break that up into 3 10-minute walks throughout the day to help break up that sedentary time? So, I'd like to start with that one, exploring what you enjoy. For those that have not regularly engaged in physical activity, it doesn't have to look like running, or some people hate walking. Maybe they like cycling or swimming. Those are things to just explore, because this is something that you are going to need to engage in for the rest of your life, right? The same way that we approach nutrition as well. You have to eat for the rest of your life. We need you moving for the rest of your life. You need to get your sleep quality on point, because you're going to bed every single night. So instead of looking for these quick hacks, think about what is something that I enjoy doing that I can do regularly to really promote longevity.
Yes, adherence to any kind of protocol is obviously the most important thing. So if people are not sticking with it, it doesn't help if we give them the best plan or the best strategy. So really, really important point. I guess pivoting a little bit into now people that have thankfully survived cancer, I'm really curious, is there anything different in terms of nutritional recommendations for cancer survivors? What do they specifically need to look out for?
Yeah, so unfortunately, our research in that area is not as robust as what we have for just overall prevention. So once we're starting to grow some research in that area, as I mentioned, that's research on soy and breast cancer survivors. That was a fairly new update. A new update came out on colorectal cancer survivors last year. So all I have to say is it's new. It's still gathering evidence in that area. And right now the recommendations are just to adhere to the recommendations that we have for initial cancer prevention. And so those two reports that I just mentioned with the breast cancer and the colorectal cancer survivors, those new reports actually do support that a healthy dietary pattern seems to be associated with better long-term survival, more focus on fiber and whole grains and colorectal cancer survivors, limiting the sugar sweetened beverages. So many of the things that come up for initial cancer prevention are popping up as being protective even after a diagnosis. So not anything drastically that needs to change. It's adhering to those initial cancer prevention recommendations.
Yeah, again, I think that makes sense, especially also in regards to the recommendation of continuing with minimally processed foods, especially also low added sugar consumption, as we, or at least from my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, but from my understanding, cancer cells or any potential cancer growth is just fueled by refined sugar if we consume too much of it in excess. Would that be a correct statement?
So I'm glad you brought that up. So this common misconception is that sugar feeds cancer. And yes, we know that cancer cells utilize a lot of fuel because they are rapidly dividing. They're dividing more quickly than other cells, and they're not stopping. So yes, they're looking for rapid fuel sources, but we can't remove all sugar from the diet and then think that the cancer is not going to continue to grow because it also still needs protein and fat and vitamins and minerals. But I will say yes, that our recommendations are still about limiting added sugars because blood glucose control is important for overall metabolic health as well. So I think I like to find that nuance of not to think that if you eliminate all added sugar, then cancer is not going to grow. But we also don't recommend having a high amount of added sugar in your diet because we need to still consider metabolic health, blood glucose control, and having room in your diet for nutrient-dense foods, which aren't typically high sugar foods either.
Well, thank you so much for, I guess, dispelling that myth or that common misconception. And again, what I like about this is it's helping us not to fearmonger certain things, where someone, if they're, having a cupcake on their daughter's birthday and they're thinking, oh no, am I suddenly growing my cancer again or something like that, that stress that comes from that can probably be worse for the person than the cupcake itself.
100%. Yes, I'm glad you acknowledge that because I've definitely worked with patients who are scared to enjoy those things again because of the sugar feeds cancer. I'm like, it's not that one cupcake. It's what are you doing the rest of the day? Do you have good blood glucose control the rest of the day? This isn't going to make or break you now. It's not something we're going to recommend that you have a cupcake every day, but also to enjoy your foods and think of that in the context of everything else that you're doing to support your health. And yeah, as you mentioned, stress can increase blood sugar levels. So let's be mindful of that as well.
That's something I wanted to talk about in general anyway. When it comes to, I mean, this is not necessarily diet and cancer prevention, but we do know that stress overall, any kind of stress is something that is probably conducive to unfortunately cancer cells. So again, in terms of practical ways, how do you recommend people lower their stress or their perceived stress for that matter, in terms of prevention, but also throughout and after cancer treatment?
Right, because we do know that some harmful effects of stress is that it can, as I mentioned, increase your blood sugar level. You think you're in like this fight or flight response and impact your insulin sensitivity as well. Your ability to get that deep restorative sleep is going to be altered if you're waking up in the middle of the night with your mind wandering. And then that can also impact how you are eating the next day if you're not getting good sleep. Or if you're stressed, we know that impacts how people make dietary choices. So one thing I kind of like to address with my patients is because there's a lot of stress in their lives and building up that resilience toolbox. What are other ways that you can manage stress that isn't many of us can easily go to is food. The pantry is there. Food can be a quick way to kind of numb that emotion, but it is not the only tool that you should be using in the toolkit. So I'm talking about what are other things that you can add to the toolkit. So I've made recommendations that patients connect with their social worker at the cancer center and talk through these things because this is life altering diagnosis. And I think I'm just going to get through it on my own to get that help and work with a professional who can help you build that toolbox of ways to manage your stress because meditation doesn't work for everyone. Exercise might take the edge off a little bit, but might not work for everyone. So it's finding what works for you. And I say there's nothing wrong with using food once in a while to help numb that emotion or manage that emotion, but it should not be the only tool in your toolbox. on that. So that's why I talk about with managing stress is working with somebody who's going to help you determine what are the tools that work best for you.
That's a really good recommendation. And I think to the point of food, again, I like that you're really trying to get people away from that all or nothing thinking. And I think as long as the decisions are conscious and we think about how is this going to make me feel afterwards, and we feel like we're in control while we're eating it and not this sort of ravenous, I can't stop, and then afterwards I feel guilty and I beat myself up and I just feel gross type of thing. That's certainly not something that we want to encourage. And to the point of, yeah, talking with someone about that, I do think that unfortunately in our society nowadays, we probably often don't have a strong enough network around us of people that we feel like we can not necessarily offload, but even just talk to and have good interactions with, and just that support where we feel heard no matter what. And so unfortunately sometimes, or not unfortunately, I guess, but yeah, I guess a good alternative is talking to a professional, and then with that in parallel, maybe putting in more effort into, hey, where can I build community? Where can I build friendships? Where can I connect with people that I used to know? Or where can I make new friends? And Crystal, I'm someone I travel a lot. I'm a digital nomad, so to speak. And so with that, I have learned I really need to put myself out there, and making friends as an adult is something that feels really strange, because you normally things happen like sort of organically. You have your old school friends, or you meet people if through your kids, if you have kids. But if you're not in either of those situations, it's like, okay, I actually need to put an effort in and say hello to this other heart training lady at the gym and just compliment her for that, and maybe ask her for a coffee, or if she wants to have coffee in a few weeks. It's odd, but you get into the habit of that.
I love that. It's like you said, it's a lot harder as an adult because then you're putting yourself out there and it's not those natural environments where you're going to be meeting people. But as you mentioned, building that community is so important. Lots of research in that area as well about community and connections. Because then, right, you said it could be someone that you can just talk to and, doesn't necessarily need to fix, they don't need to fix anything. You just need to be heard. That's a big part of it, just being heard. Like therapy thing, I think some people think like, oh, they're just going to try to fix me or tell me that something's wrong. Like sometimes it's just a sounding board and you just need someone, especially someone going through cancer treatment, their family is going through a lot as well. So they don't want to offload on their families. So to have a neutral person and to speak to about these things. And kind of circle back about what you're saying with the food. If it is something where you're feeling like out of control and you get negative emotions when you're eating that, well, then that's not really a good stress reliever. You just induced more stress. So we got to break that cycle and exactly finding the tools that are actually going to make you feel better, whether that's coffee with a new friend, a brisk walk outside, maybe journaling, but everyone's got their own tools.
Absolutely. Yeah. Love that visualization there. And I guess talking about, the tough time of going through cancer treatment and so on, of course, emotionally very tough, but I can imagine it's also tough in terms of perhaps changes in appetite, perhaps changes in taste and so on. So, what are some ways or some things people need to keep in mind throughout their treatment as it pertains to nutrition?
So unfortunately, having a consult with a dietitian is not standard of care when someone has a cancer diagnosis. So many individuals are kind of walking through this on their own and trying to figure out what works and what doesn't work. And so if you truly are struggling with this and your cancer center doesn't have someone to support you to seek out an oncology dietitian that can, because sometimes these things aren't intuitive, like taste changes that feel like there's metal in your mouth. What do you eat? What's okay to eat? Or if you have mouth sores, what's okay to eat? That working with a dietitian can help personalize that. But also wanted to frame that sometimes I hear from patients that they hear from their oncologists or providers, eat whatever you want, which in one way I get where they're trying to maybe reduce that pressure on the patient. Don't want them to lose weight, but the message kind of comes across as, well, nutrition doesn't matter. In that case, and it does. The research does support that good nutrition helps support good outcomes in an individual. Because sometimes people hear that, eat whatever you want, then it's more carb heavy. They're not getting adequate protein. They're not getting their vitamins and minerals, and it could actually make things worse. So there's many potential side effects that can happen, and it depends on someone's therapy. Not everyone has all the same side effects. And I'll just briefly mention that in some cancers, they actually gain weight, like breast cancer, gynecologic cancers. We commonly see prostate cancer. There's actually weight gain because of the therapies, versus some had expected. Well, I thought I was going to lose weight. That's what a lot of people associate a cancer diagnosis with, some of the weight loss. And yes, there are some cancers where that's more of an issue. So, kind of setting this all up is one that nutrition matters. Everyone's side effects are going to be different, and it can be hard to eat during those times. So, working with an oncology dietitian that can help you navigate that is best. And then to recognize that weight gain may happen in some situations, and you might need some support around that as well.
Well, I'm almost shocked. I will say that some physicians might say that nutrition doesn't play a role, or that just say eat whatever, because yeah, I mean, what goes into our body obviously fuels the processes and everything else in the body as well. So I'm glad that there are people like you out there that educate us that that is not the case. And so one thing that you also mentioned was the protein there, and I mean, not just cancer patients, but many, many people, most people probably that are not aware of it, kind of don't get enough protein in our diet these days. So what are some practical ways, again, that you recommend for your cancer patients that are going through treatment, but also everyone else to get enough protein, given that, again, we mentioned, potent staying away from processed meats, minimal red meat, perhaps, or high quality red meat, if that, and so on. So, what would be some practical ways to still get in enough protein?
Yeah, so protein is especially important during cancer treatment because many of these therapies are also damaging healthy cells. So we need those building blocks for those healthy cells to come back. Also, immune function starts to take a dip from these therapies. So we need to have the proteins to build the antibodies and these immune cells. So protein needs are higher during cancer treatment and also a bit higher in that initial recovery phase. It's not like you're done with treatment and it's all good. There's still a road to recovery. And especially during high stress, we see more muscle loss. You don't, especially intentional weight loss. Like we don't get to choose. They only take energy from this belly fat area. Unfortunately, the body's taking from wherever, including muscle, that will get impacted by that. So, yes, we do focus a lot on what are some ways to get protein in the diet. One thing I always start off with, and maybe your listeners are already on this, is calculate what your needs are. Don't take a guess about how much protein you should have. There are recommendations for example, during cancer, we're recommending somewhere from 1 to 1.5 grams per kilogram of body weight. So I'd sit down and calculate that with them. And that number doesn't really mean anything unless you know how much protein is in different foods. So kind of walk through what are some of the foods that you consume and how much protein is that really providing. So they'll say, well, I have a couple of eggs for breakfast. That's like 12 grams. And we're trying to get to 100. This isn't gonna cut it. So that's where really focus on having a high protein food at every single eating occasion, especially when those protein needs are high. It's like every bite matters. I know you like having fruit, that's great, but could we pair that with something that has some more protein in there? It's great that you're having a salad with lots of veggies. Let's add some protein to that. So, my practical strategy is every time you're eating, it should be something that has a good source of protein, especially when those needs are higher.
I absolutely said, and I think even just that single recommendation of like, okay, yes, figuring out what are high protein foods, and that's normally where we start off with our clients as well. Like, hey, let's just track what you're eating at the moment. Can be in terms of food diary or using one of these fancy apps at the moment, and so you actually know. Oh no, I'm actually only getting, I don't know, 50 grams per day. Like you mentioned, how can I get to double that or even more? And then coming up with some practical strategies, and by recording that, you also learn, okay, maybe peanut butter is not the best protein source. Maybe I actually need to add, some Greek yogurt to that or whatever it might be. And the benefit, of course, of having this higher protein consumption, again, as you mentioned with fiber, is that it's more satiating than other things. And of course, if we eat more of this, then we automatically eat less of the processed stuff. And I've sometimes found, like, if people are like visual, giving a recommendation of, I don't know, a palm-sized portion or something like that can sometimes help as well, because yeah, if we just think one egg, is that enough, or a little dollop of yogurt, no, it's probably not enough. I'm sorry.
Yeah, exactly. It's like doing that. Let me actually see what this looks like. Let me track and think, how close am I to where I need to be? And maybe it's going to take three dollops of that yogurt, not just one. Or as you mentioned, so I said eggs. I think people think that they're super high in protein. They have protein, but that's going to be, need a lot of eggs. Peanut butter often get a lot of misconception. Hummus, like those are things that add a little bit here and there. But when we're reaching goals of have patients at 100, 120 grams, that's really not going to get us where we need to be. And often too, people think, oh, need more protein, have to take a protein supplement. We don't need to start there. Let's start with the foods. Yes, there's times during treatment where appetite's low and they've got a lot of barriers to eating, like metallic taste changes. Meat does not go well with that. They can actually taste a little bit more of that metal. So, protein smoothies may be a way that we get that, but really always start with a foods first approach. Higher protein does not mean that you automatically need a protein supplement.
Yeah, and I would say that another benefit to that approach with having a protein and plant-forward diet, again, being the blood sugar regulation that you mentioned earlier, if we're having those spikes that and we want to avoid them, particularly, I think in the morning, breaking our fast with something that is high in protein and fiber and maybe some healthy fats is so much of a better approach than what unfortunately we often tend to do, either being just on a coffee and then grabbing a muffin or a cereal or toast and jam or whatever, and then being surprised that you're hungry again 2 hours later, or if that.
Yeah, that's a great point. Another benefit of protein is that good blood glucose control over time. And that's when I have the patients that are worried about sugar and then they're not eating fruit and then they're worried about carbs. And like there are way bigger picture things that we can do to truly manage your blood sugar while not having to restrict healthy foods. As you mentioned, more protein at your meals, exercise, pairing those carbs with some protein and fat. That those are ways that we can have better blood glucose control without having to cut large food groups out of your diet.
Awesome. And this might be a little bit of a random question, but is there anything throughout cancer treatment that people should think of or perhaps think of automatically as it pertains to meal timing when it comes to like around the treatments?
It depends on the therapy. I typically recommend for those that are getting chemotherapy around those days, many of them get steroids. And that's a way to help reduce the severity of the side effects around that time, trying to manage that. But we know that steroids increase blood sugar levels. So we just work on being a little bit more lower, maybe a little lower carb on those days, have a little bit more protein heavy those days because blood sugar is already running pretty high. And so when you're coming down from that high, it can feel more like garbage. Once that dips down back into normal levels, I'm like, if we don't add to that pile up of sugar, that could be a way to help manage some side effects as well. So that's mainly just for those that are getting that type of chemotherapy with steroids. Then we talk about meal timing. General recommendations too that I give to anyone is we shouldn't be eating very close to bedtime. So important for these individuals to get restorative quality sleep. The body is in deep recovery. It's going to need that deep recovery mode. So we try to limit eating close to bedtime so that they're not also digesting foods. It also might look different that it's not three meals a day with a couple of snacks. It might be multiple small meals throughout the day because that's all they can really tolerate at one time. So say that there's really not one perfect way of eating. There's some ways that we can navigate that based on the side effects that people are dealing with or the therapies that they're on. But general recommendations, we want to not eat so close to bedtime. I do recommend that they do have breakfast because it's going to be a lot harder to try to meet all of your nutritional meals in a short window.
Right. I think those are some very practical takeaways, also for people not just in treatment at the moment. And the very last point I just wanted to touch on, going back to what you said initially in terms of the recommendation, was alcohol. And I know the listeners, they're probably rolling their eyes because I do keep
Yes.
touching on alcohol. And as the listeners also know, I personally choose to not drink alcohol. I just feel better without it. But yeah, maybe you can tell us from a scientific point of view as well why, in terms of cancer prevention, it is a good idea to at least limit it.
Yes, yeah, you know, the limitations and to recognize that, sure, it's a dose response and that really a J-shaped curve, because after we get to moderate intakes, that we see a steep rise in that increase of cancer risk. But why they put this specific recommendation of there's really no safe level of alcohol is because it's a known carcinogen. It's like saying that there's a safe number of cigarettes, right? We know that it's a carcinogen that you're introducing into the body, so there could be damage. So to say that there would be no harm is not following the science about what this compound is. So what we do know about alcohol is that alcohol gets metabolized to acetaldehyde, and that can damage DNA. And it's that DNA damage that can contribute to cancer. So it's not just one time you get damaged. Yes, our body can repair it. So think about how often you're exposing your body to that potential damage there. Also, there's some concern about how it could increase the risk of breast cancer is that it could impact estrogen levels and potentially increase estrogen levels because the liver does metabolize extra estrogen to kind of kick that out to be thrown into the intestine to end up in a bowel movement. It's always trying to help with hormone balance there. So when alcohol is a priority for the liver to deal with, then it's not metabolizing that estrogen that it needs to help get to lower levels. So through the metabolism of alcohol itself, it's producing a byproduct that can damage DNA. As I mentioned, it could also increase estrogen levels. It's also associated with increased risk of, we know, anything that alcohol touches. So the mouth, the esophagus, gastric, colorectal cancer, because it can going to increase the penetration of other carcinogens, increase the ability of other carcinogens to penetrate as well. So that's where the recommendation comes from with alcohol. And yes, that moderate intake's probably not going to significantly increase risk, but there is a slight increased risk at even one drink a day.
Thank you for explaining that so clearly, and especially also in regards to estrogen, because many of the listeners and many of our clients are either in perimenopause or menopause. And so oftentimes the question is, or when I give the recommendation, hey, let's really lay off of alcohol, especially throughout those hormonal imbalances, I think that explains it very, very well. So thank you so much for that. And thank you just in general for your time and for sharing your wisdom with us. It's super, super helpful. As I said, I will most certainly share all your links in the show notes so people can go and check out all your content. But yeah, just truly grateful for your time.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to discuss this with your audience. And I know that those that probably listen are very health conscious and sounds like the exercising, focusing on protein, more plant forward, that's going to have benefits for cancer prevention as well. So on the right track.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Crystal. Thank you so much for tuning in. Go and give us both a follow on Instagram or YouTube. And remember, if you want personalized help with your nutrition and fitness goals, we'd love to guide you. One more thing before you go, if you are looking for premium supplements, our partner Fat Muscle Project has got you covered. Head to their website for the best protein powders, creatine, vitamin D, and more, and feel free to use our code NCL at the checkout. Thank you for listening.